Unter anderem, was konnte ich denn nicht sehen? Asked the department has given them an opportunity to decide who's going to do what. I see they are still caucusing there. As to who's going to report on what. We are ready now. Okay, I'll hand it back to you, ma'am, and take us through the responses.
Okay, thanks so much, Chairperson. I think we'll each of
I appreciate if you prioritize on Dr. James' responses because he'll be leaving at 5 to 2.
Okay. We will do that. Thank you. So I will respond to one or two questions raised, and then all the relevant DDGs will respond to the questions related to their program areas as far as possible. In terms of the question raised by the Honourable Member Wilma James, in terms of the Office of Health Standards Compliance and the reliance to report against some of our hospital indicators based on the assessment, we have come up with a strategy to deal with that. We will no longer in the future be doing that. It's just that this indicator was written as such in the APP, so we have to almost like tag it along until the financial year ends. But at the same time, to improve, to facilitate service delivery improvements, the branch has decided, the hospital cluster has decided to work with the results of the patient experience of care or the patient satisfaction surveys, the staff satisfaction survey, as well as clinical data from clinical indicators from the DHIS and the data on that to drive service delivery improvements with the hospitals, as well as reports from the AG. But this doesn't preclude also working with inspection reports of the office when that does come. But the main kind of strategy is for us to work with the patient and patient experience of care survey and staff satisfaction survey to guide the service delivery improvement. In terms of the question on the foreign nationals, the foreign interns, I think I'm just going to ask Andrew to give a quick update there. It's quite simple. The countries that where these foreign national students come from.
Thank you. Chair, the foreign medical interns that were employed by the Department of Health at the beginning of last year were employed as part of an extended agreement with SADC countries where we exchange medical students in particular between the countries. 37 of them were employed by the National Department for 1 year and then would be transferred after that 1 year to provinces who would then continue their employment. We have 14 from Botswana, 4 from Mauritius, 1 from Namibia, 1 from Nigeria, 4 from Swaziland, 1 from Zambia, and 12 from Zimbabwe. And these individuals will be going onto provincial budgets as of the next financial year.
Okay, thanks. And then in relation to another question on that I'd like to address myself now is the one on blood toxicology tests and why the backlog. Now, I don't know if honourable members remember last year we reported in the last presentation when we presented our annual report in quarter one, we spoke of a new approach to testing for toxicology. Toxicology testing, where we're moving from a broad sky approach to a more targeted approach, even a blue sky approach, where you test for many toxins, to one where we're moving to a more targeted approach, where we're going to be testing for only 10 poisons. And the list of these poisons, I think they might still be working on it in finalizing, you know, which specific poisons they're going to target to test. But once that is done, the actual staffing no longer becomes an issue because this approach will drastically reduce the number of tests that will be done and also the turnaround time for results. So seemingly there is not really a problem with staffing. However, we will get a status update report, and I think then we can forward that, a brief report to the honourable members. Those are the two I would like to touch on. So then I think we can move.
Do you want to do the revenue one? Okay. Okay, I have a few, but I'll do the revenue one so that I deal with the questions. In relation to revenue, I think it's important to first recognize that the provincial departments of health are generally not collecting the amounts of revenue relative to their potential to collect the revenue. There are a variety of reasons for that. One of the key issues is that there is no incentive for them to collect the revenue because they don't retain it. The only province that has been effectively been able to collect revenue retain it has been the Western Cape. And the reason they've been able to do it is because they have an agreement between the Provincial Department of Health and Provincial Treasury that they retain some of the revenue. So they use the revenue to then support the infrastructure of the facility. And so we've been able to understand that model and persuade other provinces to do the same. The difficulty is obviously that the provincial treasury and the national treasury need to be on board on this. So we've been trying to get the FFC to support us so that this policy proposal can be adopted by other provincial departments. And so currently we're in the process of finalizing that, and we're hoping that all provincial treasury will then adopt the revenue retention strategy, which would allow then facilities to retain a portion of the revenue that they actually collect, and so there'll be an incentive to do it. In terms of the billing specifically relating to that, there's what's referred to as the Uniform Patient Fee Schedule. And the UPFS has been costed, and that's the basis on which the fees are supposed to be charged. However, each provincial legislature can decide to levy an alternative fee relating to a particular procedure. So we at the National Health Council last year had an agreement with the MECs that we will be gazetting the UPFS, and it should be the basis on which all provinces then levy a fee relating to these services. So we have agreement on that, and that we will be publishing the UPFS, which becomes the basis on which all provinces will levy fees. The other questions maybe I can answer later so that we can deal with all Honourable James Wilmot's questions.
Will the ideal clinic ever happen, and how far it is? And an honourable member also asked, if we say the clinic is ideal, is it really ideal? Does it do what it needs to do? So we started the implementation of the ideal clinic in the 2015-16 financial year. The work that we did before that was planning work, and we started from a zero base. There were no ideal clinics. If honourable members remember, when the health system trust baseline audit results were released, there was one facility in the whole country that met standards, and it was a hospital in the northwest. We ended that year, as we had reported in the forum as well, that the 15-16 year was 322 clinics. But unfortunately, the way we've worded our APP target this year, we said additional clinics. So we can't report on the 322. We have to say what are we bringing on additionally. So this year so far, and the year hasn't ended yet, we have 267 clinics, so we need to add the 322 to the 267. And I'm positive we'll end this year with more than the 267. On the response to the question, are these clinics really ideal when they are ideal? This is a program that we implement jointly with the Department of performance management and evaluation, the PPME. And at the last quarterly meeting Minister Motsoaledi had with the minister in the DPME, the minister of DPME told us about clinics that he visited, and he was surprised to find that they are actually not ideal. It's because we are very, very sick. So when we say they are ideal, they must be ideal, there are weighted elements that talks about the availability of oxygen, the fact that the staff can actually handle medical emergencies. So if you don't have staff trained on basic life support, if you don't have those things that needed for life-saving measures, you can score 80%, but you cannot be an ideal clinic, because we want to make sure the clinic can do what they're supposed to do. Nevertheless, the numbers that I'm citing at the moment, 500 and something out of the total 3,477 clinics, it's a slow progress, and we are not happy with it. Because Minister, to use the words that were used earlier, also words that Minister likes to use, he says he doesn't like this picky-picky mark here. We've got a system and we need to fix the system like yesterday. But we do have serious challenges, Chairperson and members. That's why the baseline was zero. And I'll just mention the top three. Number one is infrastructure. It is true that too many of the clinics are too small and too many of the clinics are falling down. But incidentally, that is the one area where we are performing the best now in health. There was also a question about the list of clinics that we said we refurbished and rebuilt. And we will send those, because we do have it. In fact, we have a very extensive report, not just about the clinics, but exactly where we are with them and the ones that have been opened and so on. And we also recently sent it to the DPMA. So with infrastructure, we at the moment, 2016 February, we're doing well, and we're going to be doing better because we put all the building blocks in place. There is what they call these panels where we can now just, we don't have to go on long, a lengthy tenders. We've got a panel of service providers that we've obtained through tenders. So now we ask them to compete. We can choose three and say, we want this clinic rebuilt, let us get the three quotes, and we okay that process with the chief procurement office to say that this process is above board for health to be moving faster with infrastructure improvement. Chair, the second big challenge with getting ideal clinics is human resources, and it's going to be more difficult. It's going to be more difficult than infrastructure, because we're going to need funding, but we have worked as a department. I'm so glad we don't have to say to you anymore, we are busy with Wizen. We completed Wizen for primary health care. And the findings of the Wizen is that we don't have a shortage of professional nurses in our clinics. We have shortage of doctors, but more significantly, we have shortage of cleaners, data capturers, and groundsmen. So professional and other categories of nurses like enrolled nurses and assistant nurses. So professional nurses end up doing the cleaning work, they do data capturing, they do things like vital signs, measurement, which an assistant nurse could do. And so it looks like we're short of professional nurses. But we are not short of professional nurses. But the process of getting the staffing right is going to be a difficult process, but we are going to take it on with the Treasury to say if we're going to provide the services for South Africans that the country expects us to, we have to staff their facilities properly. Thirdly, this ever issue, our continuous lament of supply chain. But Chairperson and Honourable Members, before we started the Ideal Clinic Framework, to actually be able, that framework enables us to say to this clinic, but you have been without bone manometers for this period, why? You have been without this for this period, why? And I have to repeat what I always say. When we talk about supply chain, we don't include medicines. Our supply to our medicine supply to our clinics are very good, so much so that South Africans are spoiled. If they just don't get anything, especially in Gauteng, they are going to make a big thing about it. So, but our supply chain issues are about medical equipment, and it's about cleaning material, and it's about surgical surgeries, the things you need to do, wound care, and so on. But so through this framework, and ever since we started the program, even with the planning, we report regularly to the Tech NHC where the HOD sits. And we have been saying repeatedly to HODs their supply chain problems. But it's only when we understood the specifics and we could say, point to the specifics, that we could actually go to the provinces and say, now we want to see what's happening in your supply chain. We found out that one province had no supply chain structure at the provincial level and at the district level. So it was like, so how was supply chain going to happen? We had reported that we are working with National Treasury on a national catalog. We had found out that these very things that the clinics need, there is no valid transversal tenders where they can just order the things from. So you want manometers, but everyone is looking at everyone, and the clinic staff says, but we send the requisition up, and nobody communicates to them that there is no valid tender to get manometers from. And so unfortunately, we've had to go down from national, just like we had to as national design that framework to say, but this is what you must have. Let us measure you and see what you don't have. We also had to go and find out why is it that they can't get the supplies into the clinic. And then I want to say, the ideal clinic framework, because it's so specific and we can measure where we are, which means we can clearly see what we still need to do, is a framework that must continue. And I want to thank this committee for the support in calling provinces last year to report, and I want to ask for the committee's continued support for this framework if we are going to continue improving the quality of our clinics. For example, the Western Cape had decided they're not going to partake in the program, but because I think of questions out of this committee, they did start on 1 April 2016 with a program, and the staff on the ground are very excited, and they're saying, this gives us a very specific idea of what we need to do to improve quality. So I'll leave the ideal clinic there, Chair. I also need to speak to the issue of ward-based outreach teams. So the reports we receive, Chair, as reported here, are reports that we get from the provinces. But it's not the first time that the committee raises the issue of that they don't see they don't see the ward-based outreach teams when they don't go to the clinics, and it's for that reason that the minister gave instructions that we develop a database, which we did, of every community health worker by name, ID number, and where they work. Chair, the committee would have noticed that we had set a target of 2,000 functional ward-based primary health care outreach teams, where last year we already reported more, and you will see the quarterly numbers on more. It's because as health, we realize we need to improve what is happening in this area, and it needs to start with the improvement of the conditions of service of the community health workers. And so if we are going to improve that community health workers, we have to have manageable numbers to be able to afford within the current purse as we continue asking Treasury for more funding. We'll have to have numbers that we manage if we're going to improve the conditions, but we are committing to improving the conditions as health again. We are committing to finding out where these workers work, and then we will have to set up a tracking system and a monitoring and evaluation system, because it is the one area where workers could say I've been at work when they have not been at work. We've already started, chaired by the DG, conversations with different unions, because we'll have to take the unions along with us step by step as we formalize the working conditions of the community health workers. And we actually need to be guided by the unions about pitfalls, because we have to do this in light of conditions of other health workers like assistant nurses and so on. The district mental health team, This is an objective that the National Department set for the health system in its policy framework and strategy 2013-2020. The minister launched the policy framework and strategy in 2013, and one of the objectives is starting with the NHI pilot that each district must have a district mental health team. And this team consists of a psychiatrist, a psychiatric nurse, an occupational therapist, a social worker, and a psychologist, as 5 team members. And they are not meant to consult with patients, but they must plan the public health services. For example, the deinstitutionalization issue in Gauteng. The district mental health team must plan the services. In the Mental Health Care Act, we've already defined how it must happen. We have designed tools against which to measure facilities, whether they comply to take patients as the, not patients, it's mental health care users, because these are not supposed to be sick people. It's intellectually disabled individuals. Chair and members, even if you don't read the Ombuds report, but if you look at the annexures to that report, and it is on the Office of Health Standards Compliance website, you would see that these people are actually trying to do their work. There's an email and a letter that was written by the project manager. And the project manager is not a mental health care professional. But if you if you look at the content, the project manager was trying to give the NEC very good advice. And the project manager was advised by these technical teams on the ground. There's another letter from a doctor at Tara, and she says this: I write this letter on behalf of the doctors in the hospital and on behalf of the community-based professionals. So these professionals are there. They're passionate about mental health, and they're passionate about the right thing happening. The posts of that, we are saying we can't fill posts, but we know there's a problem with not being able to fill community service environmental health officers. Chairperson, these are posts, management posts, and they are not just in environmental health, but they also, it was also managers in the district health system. And when we appoint the managers within government, we have to follow DPSA regulations in terms of qualifications and postgraduate qualifications and numbers of years of experience. So unfortunately, it is, as it happened, we couldn't find suitable candidates, had to re-advertise and also go into headhunting. The random monitoring of salt, so when we designed the regulation, there was an agreement that the government will take 13 categories of foodstuffs that's very high in salt content, and also the kinds of foodstuffs that South Africans frequently use, because we wanted to make a health impact on the health of South Africans. And they are bread, they are butter and butter spreads, they are cured meats is one category, uncured meats is another category, cereal snacks, crisps, as the Americans call it, here in our country we call it chips, Simba chips. And the chips, the crisps is one category, and then salt and vinegar chips on its own is another category, because you have different salt levels for each category. The soups and soup powder, like these Knorrox blocks, what they call them, flavoring blocks, and so on. So there's 13 of them. And so the industry, because we work hand in hand with industry, in these areas of health promotion, we try to have a balance between legislation and getting South Africans as well as industry to also voluntarily comply. So we don't just want to throw the law book at society. So we gave them a deadline of June 2016, and we actually did the test just a couple of months before the deadline to see how ready they are to comply, and we found only 50% compliance. We were disappointed at that stage. But in line with this of wanting the balance between legislation and voluntary compliance,
we are planning together the remedial actions together with the industry. The issue of the SLA chairperson, indeed, there is no way that we can make an outside organization start work without an SLA, because we won't be able to pay them. So what that line was intending to say is that, and it happens in my sections, that's why Ian has asked me to answer, this last quarter we battle, because we need to ensure that their annual report, and it's not even the annual report, because their financial years, unfortunately, is different from our financial year. Some of them start 1 July. That their annual report and their audited financial statements is in line with what the SLA prescribes they need to do for us, so that we make sure we pay them for what we ask them to do. And I think I'm through. Yes, with mine, COO. Thank you.
Thanks, Jeanette. I think then Ian, what are you? Okay. Anban, will you go next?
Okay. Thank you. So the other question related to SAPRA and the overspending around SAPRA. So just to say that the budget allocated to SAPRA was intended to support SAPRA in terms of resources to be able to deliver its mandate more effectively. The matter relating to its public entity status is progressing as well. So I'll just talk a little bit about the funding allocation. So Treasury had funded, had provided additional funds so that SAPRA could employ more people so that they could deal with all the applications that they currently receive and address the slow registration time. So that funding had come through late relatively to the expectation from SAPRA so that they would be able to employ these people. Speaking specifically about whether SAPRA would be ready on 1 April, we had anticipated that Treasury would have listed SAPRA as a public entity in order for us to be able to advertise the board. Their view was that we must first fill the post of a CFO and human resources manager before actually they would be able to list. Ordinarily, one appoints a board and then appoints a CEO and then you appoint the CFO and HR manager, etc. So we're having to create those positions so that Treasury could then list SAPRA. So our view is that once the listing happens, we can then advertise the nominations for the board members and fill that, and the board could then deal with the issue of the CEO. So we're planning to still try and achieve 1 April. Obviously, there's some dependency with Treasury around that. In terms of the other question relating to the outcome of performance management system, this indicator we introduced after observing the performance of our entities and councils. Our understanding is that none of the other departments actually do so. We took this idea from the way private entities are managed in terms of the King report. And so we use some of the indicators that King has in their report to apply to the public sector. And so the intention was to try and improve the performance of boards in the areas that we had identified. So we can certainly share the report about what their performance is with a view to try and improving that performance. And then the question around the NHI underspending. I think it's important to reflect on the expenditure on in terms of NHI relative to the various areas. So if I can just take you to the page relating to the NHI expenditure particularly, you will see that the expenditure as it relates to what the National Department is responsible for, we're doing very well. So on page 87, you will see that our expenditure as it relates to CCMDD or the health practitioner contracting is actually, spending is going very well and actually exceeding what the target is. However, when you look at areas such as machinery and equipment, for example, the expenditure is poor, and that's largely for the reasons that Ms. Hunter referred to earlier around facilities being able to access the machinery and equipment. One of the proposals that I had made to the chief procurement officer was, rather than all of the facilities trying to get quotations to purchase equipment, or for them all trying to do tenders, it may be useful to have a catalogue, because the equipment that the facilities buy are similar across the country. Why not have a catalogue and negotiate the price, the chief procurement officer negotiates a price with a reference price, and so they can purchase off anybody on that catalogue, so there's no need to do a quotation or do a tender, this expires and then they're not able to buy, etc. So the chief procurement officer can do that in the private sector, for example. That's what they do in, I mean, the private hospitals, for example, have a catalogue, and all their facilities then buy off that catalogue and they revise it regularly as they negotiate prices. So I think that may be an easier way for us to solve the supply chain issue in, as we're experiencing it currently, particularly around equipment and consumables and the like.
Yeah, maybe on this equipment story, you see, maybe just clarify where lies the bottleneck, because we've gone to provinces and we're going to the NHI private sites and there are no equipment, and they say there's no money. That's the story that they told us. It's either no money or they are not allowed to procure anything. Where exactly lies the problem? Now, where is the money here? It's not being accessed, not being utilized. You go to the provinces, they tell you a complete different story around the issue of procurement of equipment. Where exactly lies the problem? Well, I'm not talking about general now.
Yeah.
I'm specific on the NHI pilot side, because that's where we went. And that's where we found a big problem. With most facilities doesn't have the necessary equipment, and the story that they're telling us is almost the same everywhere where we've gone. So I'm not sure exactly where lies the problem. Because the issues we are raising vis-a-vis what they're telling us, it doesn't comprehend to each other.
I'm sure the CFO will be able to assist as well, but in my experience around trying to resolve the problem, firstly, the facilities that have the requirements, so we go to the facilities and say what equipment you need, and they'll give us a list, and then we plan based on that. But the facility still operates within a district and a province, and so they are still bound by those rules. So when transfers happen, and the CFO will talk about it, the transfers go to the level of the province, and the facility has no site. So when a provincial official says to him or her, there's no money, they know no better. The second problem is that when equipment is needed, in order to procure the equipment, the first thing you have to do in supply chain is define what you want to buy. So it's easy with fast cube moving consumer goods, like if you want to buy this bottle of water, you know how to describe it. But if you want to buy a bonometer or the like, you need to know how to describe it. Now, if the officials there are not able to do that, or if that function is lying at a head office level, these officials are they're handcuffed. And in the national department, we have no ability to do that. And Ian's been trying to go to provinces and try and get them to order based on what other provinces have done. But that still requires them to do the work. We can't physically go and place the orders for them. So we know what they need. We know where the money is, but to do the rest, unfortunately, it's not in our not in our hands as such. I mean, I'm sure Mr. Van Werber can say more about that.
Maybe before that, you want to make a follow-up on the same so that they respond to the same issue?
Yeah.
Based on the experience that we have seen when we're visiting those NHI,
you know, I have noted here that if in 2017 the facilities don't have a supply chain system in place, they don't have to be there. You don't need them. They are not supposed to be there at all. But now he came up with some good idea that they would rather have a catalog and buy for them. And this is what we have been saying, that they don't have the capability to do or the capacity to do this thing. Why not do the thing and say, now, This is the hospital. It's refurbished, it's re-equipped, and it's restocked. You can mess it up. Then we have one source to blame, and we don't have to be running around looking at different what entities in different corners. And that will solve our problem. You can't manufacture them. If they are not there, they are not there. If they don't know what they have to do, they can't do it if they don't know it. It's your duty to do it for them. I mean, it's easier to buy equipment in bulk and distribute it to where they need it than to say, this one is going to sign this document, this one is going to sign. He doesn't even know what it is, like he said, what it is that is needed. So I think we shouldn't be talking about this over and over again. Let's agree that you'll sort out this procurement thing, even if you have to do it yourself.
And taking into consideration that the, I'm not sure what is the legality and the illegality around conditional grants. I will understand if Peter will share, you can't do anything about it. But conditional grant is based on the business plan that they should have submitted, and you know what are the items that is required. And if they are unable to buy, why can't you buy them on their behalf and give them those equipment? And so, and because taking into consideration the state of finances in provinces as well. That's why you go there, they tell you no, because we don't meet provincial officers. Mm-hmm. We meet the institutions on the ground. And they are told, when they are telling us no, we are being told no, there's no money. Everywhere you go to the district, the district says no, we've been told that they can't procure anything by the CFO in the province. So they're stuck. But you have money here that they can't access, they can't use. You see, just becoming a merry-go-round. CFO?
Yes, thanks. I just wanted, but the point is, as Anton has said, that the conditional grant framework sets out those business plans, as you also said. We've actually gone as far as to relax some of those framework conditions to allow them to purchase all those equipment. The issue of buying on their behalf, we've done it. Last year, within 6 months, we bought 34 million rands worth of equipment. It's logistically, it's difficult to get it to provinces, get them to sign, get your asset register to balance, but we have done that. The point is that there's a big bureaucracy within the provinces. So if you're at the district level, clinic level, to get the next level to agree, means you've got to write so many submissions, you've got to come back, and the bureaucracy, unfortunately, I've seen it in Ova Tambo, for instance, where it takes weeks and weeks before it gets back to that same clinic, and then the answer is the CFO says there's no funds. So we went around end of last year, beginning of this year, to each province, and we showed them on their non-negotiables, on the equipment, only on the line that says equipment, what money is available there, right? And the money is definitely there. So to the question you asked me, what have we done? We've done a few things. We've embarked on this exercise that Jeanette has mentioned, that we are going on with the CPO to look for transversal tenders, putting out the specifications, getting it done. It takes a while to get to that point, but that's what we'd like to get to. The issue is also to work with the CPO's office to intervene on issues like the linen, the pharmaceuticals, and the equipment. The chair, the member mentioned the issue about training people. You don't find 10 people in a province that you can send for training, because in the end, you need a practitioner, a supply chain management practitioner. Let me make another example, right? Unfortunately, Northern Cape is a good example for us. We've been there many times. The bid adjudication committee that's got to do the adjudication of tenders haven't sat there for like 9 months. National, we sit twice a month at least. If we can, once a week, we sit down. So, exactly to the point. If they're not there, then they shouldn't be there. And the institution shouldn't be there, really exist. So, it's very difficult to interview. We've got a CFO forum, right? On that, we've attached what we call a supply chain management forum. And initially, it was hijacked, if I can say, by idle clinics. But we've expanded it, because idle clinics was where the biggest supply chain issue was. Fine. Honestly. Yeah, I call it idle, because we were actually just working on idle clinic equipment over and over and over again. But if those governance structures are not in the provinces, we really, you know, to start from, we really are quite dead. And let me put another rider on this thing. The churn rate of CFOs is one of the biggest issues we've got at the moment. Because every time a CFO changes, not only supply chain is his priority, many other things is his priority. And in the case of Eastern Cape, for instance, they've had a consistent CFO there for a while. Supply chain there is more or less running to a point. So I think we see all the problems. We're trying to intervene where we can. If we're going to be successful, it's going to depend mostly on the province's structures and the way they govern their supply chain. We can intervene to some extent and put pressure, and we're trying to do that. I also want to ask your other issue on the budget and how intervening on that. So, Chair, you're correct. The issue of budget intervention is something that's been close to us. And a few years ago, we started doing the non-negotiable intervention. Remember, we identified 27 areas, medicine, blood, laboratory services, all the rest of it. And we've to some extent been able to get provinces to ring-fence those budgets, right? But we're doing a budget benchmarking exercise with all provinces. We get the provincial treasury to attend, the HUD of health to attend, the CFO of health, and in some instances the national treasury. And without fail, I'm going to show you the report actually. Without fail, all provinces have got close to zero nominal growth. Talking 1% nominal growth, yeah, little bit. So if you go to the real picture, they lose 4-5% per annum on the budget. And when that happens, it becomes close to impossible to ring fence your non-negotiables. In other words, money for NHS in real terms go backwards. For medicine, blood, all those things go backwards. So if you take a very strong and very narrow view on this, you would say, what should I do to improve the situation? Because new money won't come. There's no work. The Treasury has made it clear. There will be money for odds and ends, but no new money will come. So either you've got to reduce your services platform, right? You've got to close non-existent or non-functional institutions, right? When people go on retirement or they resign, those positions don't get filled. They don't get filled, unfortunately. And you've got to look at some revenue streams. How do you improve your revenue streams? The question was there, how do you improve revenue streams? And then basically lastly is to see where can you find proper efficiency gains. But most departments will tell you that the efficiency gains, they've already squeezed that sponge to the extent where you can't find anything within it. And if you find it, you'll find a few hundred thousand here and there. You won't find the millions that we need. So in terms of the fiscals and the pressure on the sector, it's definitely growing and growing and growing. And somewhere we need to take a decision in terms of our service delivery platform and in terms of our institutions, what we can fund and not fund. The other question was on irregular expenditure, I think you mentioned. Irregular expenditure is a difficult thing to manage if you haven't got a strong CFO that can push back to the AG. In many instances, Jay, you will see that Mpumalanga, Northern Cape, the things that are declared irregular expenditure, if you've had somebody who could argue the point on a technical level with the AG, would not have been irregular expenditure. Many of those issues are there. And we've introduced a project that we copied from Gauteng on the Saika, for instance, and we're interviewing, the last few weeks, interviewing CAs to go there on a short-term basis and intervene exactly on that matter. Irregular expenditure and the existing audit outcomes. So we're doing lots. I hope to see the results of this, but much is going to depend on the leadership and the maturity of leadership, both financially and otherwise in those provinces.
Any others
in
Hunter understands?
Chair, CFO covered me well. I just want to say we do have in writing where DG wrote letters to the provinces. With attachments, we work out for them in a spreadsheet for every clinic what needs to be bought. And the exact equipment, and DG signed the letters and she sent it off, and this was after CFO went to every province to go and show them the money in their own budget. I have the same experience as you, Chair, because I work with the clinics. So no budget, But I think on higher levels, the easy answer if you don't want to do something is to say there's no money. CFO has covered me, but I just want to say we do have the proof of how hard we are working on this problem in writing. But we are hoping that the transversal levers were the right specifications, because the clinics have also bought Bowmanomas. It's brand new. It comes today, next week, it doesn't function anymore.
Hmm.
Bedsteads that give way under the nurses instead of the cast iron bedsteads that I know from my day. So so we are hoping that will, not hoping, I'm sure it is. We are going to beat this problem.
You have not indicated the 7 mental health teams. Where are they? The 7 district mental health teams.
Yes,
you just spoke about it, but without necessarily saying, so we wanted to know where are they.
Chair, I'm not exactly sure, but I can tell you Tswane has one. It's the 9, it would be the 9 pilot sites. So I don't know which 2 provinces don't have, and I will find out from the team. They will send me a message, or otherwise we'll submit through Mr. Khatla in writing. But Tswane does have a team, and that's why I was saying that team is trying its best to do its work. But I'll find out now, G.
Thanks, Chairperson. Anban, did you answer the question on the revenue,
yes.
I mean the model in the white paper? Then I think
the white paper, I didn't. Oh, okay, sorry. Yes, yes, Chair. I forgot about that question. The agreement between the Department and National Treasury is that the white paper will cover the policy aspects of NHI in terms of service delivery and configuration, etc. However, when it comes to revenue generation and how the funds will be allocated and the like, National Treasury had indicated that they will publish a document relating to that. So the white paper that we publish will not include the aspects that Treasury will raise around where the funds will come from and how the funds will flow in order to fund NHI.
Thanks, Anban.
So that means we'll have a white paper that is not costed, that is, doesn't know how it's going to be funded. That's what it means.
So I think before the white paper, the white paper minus the revenue streams is published.
You know why I'm asking this? Because there was an oral reply on this matter in the National Assembly. And the minister said he has set up streams,
yes.
Work streams that
yes.
are dealing with the funding.
Yes.
And now you are saying no, it's National Treasury. Because he never said no, it's a National Treasury matter. He said he has set up streams himself that are working on this matter. And therefore the task team was supposed to report to him in October, November. Which means by now, the work stream has reported, the minister has got a picture on how the NHI is going to be funded by now. That's our understanding as members of parliament in the context of how the ministers responded to the matter. But the picture that you are now portraying is a complete different one, that no, National Treasurer is going to come up with a model on how this thing is going to be funded. It's a contradiction in my view. Can you clarify that?
Yeah. See, I was saying, so there's 2 aspects. There's how much it's going to cost and where the money is going to come from. So we're working with Treasury about how much it might, how much it's going to cost based on how it's going to be structured. And that's what the work streams are doing. But where the money is going to come from, how the different streams of revenue are going to come together to bring you that amount of funds is what Treasury will be publishing. So how much will come from taxation, how much will come from other forms of revenue, etc. So that's Treasury's competence, and they will indicate what that is.
Okay, thanks, Chair. Then I'd like to give over to Dr. Pillay. to deal with the issues related to...
James, you wanted to make a follow-up on this, isn't it?
Thanks, CEO, and thanks, Chair and Honourable Members. So, Chair, I'm very glad you brought up the issue of the TB Caucus and the South African chapter. We were briefing the Minister on, you know, World TB Day and what we will be doing during March. And I think, as Honourable Members will recall, World TB Day is on the 24th of March. And one of the things we raised with him is the formal launch of the South African chapter of the caucus. And he said he will raise it with the MPs in Parliament on how best to do it, when to do it, etc. So I'm really pleased you said you would take it up with the Minister. But we are ready to support if any support is needed. On the issue of World TB Day, just to inform Honourable Members, is that it's been agreed that it would be held in Mangaung, in the Free State. It's Friday the 24th, so I'm sure the Minister will be signing letters of invitation to members of this committee and the Standing Committee. There's a suggestion that we're not doing too well on TB. It's partly true. We are not doing very well on MDR, multiple drug-resistant TB, but we're doing rather better on drug-resistant TB. The specific question that was asked was about the Western Cape, and we did say in the slide that the Western Cape seems to have a higher than usual death rate from TB. Turns out they've swapped two numbers, the defaulter rate with the death rate. So the death rate in the Western Cape is at 3.1%. The defaulter rate is at 9.5%. But that we didn't swap it in the National Department. It was swapped by the Western Cape erroneously. So that's what the Northern Cape is a problem, Chair. It's a problem, because, as the colleagues have been saying, on the supply chain, but there is a problem generally in the Northern Cape. And I'm not sure if the committee members have visited recently, but it seems to me a province that should be visited recently, because there's a big challenge with management there. Many of the programmatic areas are suffering as a consequence, including things like TB. On MDR-TB, just to inform the Honourable Members, we are going to be implementing, hopefully from the 1st of March, a new regimen for MDR-TB treatment. You know, at the moment, we're treating them from 18 months to 2 years with drugs that we've had for a while. We have two new drugs, bedaquiline and delaminid, and we will be starting a nine-month regimen from hopefully the 1st of March, and we should see the outcomes for drug-resistant TB improving significantly with the new regimen. But we'll be able to show you these results fairly soon. With respect to the list of mines where we've been working, we'll supply that through the committee secretariat. On the neonatal deaths, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members, it's true we are a bit stuck at about 12. What are we doing specifically? We are doing the following four things. One is we've purchased four provinces CPAP machines, continuous positive airflow machines, to help in resuscitation of neonates for 36 district hospitals, and we are going to be purchasing another 30. But to give you an example of the same supply chain problem, we can't supply the next 30 because the supplier who's contracted to supply us with the 30 is owed money for other things that the provinces have ordered, which they haven't paid. Now, we from the National Department, we're trying to give another 30, but we can't because the supplier is saying, well, you know, I've got big problems because the provinces have not paid. So we've got the CFO and his colleagues to try and help us to solve that problem. The DG has written letters to provinces. The second is to retrain nurses and doctors on helping babies breathe, which is a WHO technique. The third is the essential steps in the management of obstetric emergencies, and we've been training large numbers of doctors and nurses. And fourthly, we've just hired from the 1st of this month a pediatrician to go to the high-risk hospitals, hospitals with high numbers of neonatal mortality, to work with them on the ground, you know, in terms of mentorship and training. So the person has just started last week. So we're hoping with those four, we will be able to reduce the number of neonatal mortalities. As the CFO said, the major challenges are prematurity, and there we want especially young women to plan babies and not have them when they're unplanned, because many of those are premature, and that's one of the causes of neonatal mortality. The others are infections, and we know that's partly related to HIV, and the other is asphyxia, and that's why we are dealing with helping babies breathe and the CPAP machines. So think those are the key issues raised about Program 3. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Dr. Pillay. Any follow-up questions, or can I go on to some of the other areas that we didn't cover, Chair?
Are there any follow-up questions to Program 4? I thought that Honorable Maisela will ask about malnutrition, which is something that has been very passionate about it, and the report is not pleasing about people, children not dying as a result of that, as well as the issue around breastfeeding. Manje angizange ngayibuza lento le. But I'll give Dr. Maisela and Honorable James just to make follow-ups, and then we'll go to the next outstanding question.
Let's start with the TB one first. There is diagnostic tools that are very, very efficient, which were ahead of just a few years ago. And now you can diagnose TB with maybe 99% accuracy. But you say they owe somebody some money, and you can't supply the machine. And these machines were not, is not owed by you. Somebody owes him money. And we don't want a health system that is trial and error. We want it to work. And you are employed to make it work, not to blame somebody and say, "Yeah, we tried, man. You know this guy." No, that's not what we want to hear. We want to say you've got solutions. If you don't, purchase them. Buy the solutions if you don't have. You know, expertise, if you don't have, you buy it. Now to say, well, we're trying kanani biggie, which is it's faulty way of thinking, you understand? There's a faulty way of thinking to say, yeah, things will come right eventually. It's not what we want. We want solutions and have a working, money is there. You just said money is there, but you don't know how it is used. If you solve that one, then we'll have a working health system. We wouldn't even be asking where you get money for NHI, because if you can't fix those little things now, you are setting up for a crash, not a big failure, for a crash of NHI. And honorables, you are here to make sure that you find those solutions, not to try and say maybe, yeah, things as we go along, things will be fine. I don't take that one, but fine. And do you know it's a crime for children to die of malnutrition in South Africa? Mm-hmm. It is a crime. But children are dying of malnutrition in South Africa, the land of milk and honey. Only the milk is drank by other people, not the honey. You're sharp. But it is a crime. And we said that there is a national nutrition supplementary project. And we sat here and spoke about it, that it should be taken from the Department of Education. Nutrition is not the business of educators. It's a health problem. But because somebody wanted something, you allowed it to be hijacked. You talked about hijacking. I mean, it's a very usual thing. They hijacked the National Nutrition Supplementary Project. And how does a teacher know about nutrition? No? They just wanted the money side of it. As I'm talking now, go to any school during lunchtime. First, they don't give the children what is written on the menu. They don't know what the menu is, maybe. And secondly, you will stand there and they say the food is finished. The children run to the warden's cottage to go and buy quarters. Meanwhile, because the food is finished, when the children were standing in they cook with small pots. It's not, it's whoever went to the queue first that get the food. And you want to cry when you see this, because most often, it is the only meal they are going to have during that day. And if they don't have money for quota, they sit there and cry. No? In this age and era, but we have you here who is supposed to salvage us from this mess, and you don't have any solution. And you can't even, it's not even your problem now. It's somebody's problem. You know? And we sit here and talk about malnutrition. You don't talk about it in the classroom or in the staff room. It's us here. No, I hope that maybe you'll, if we must sit down, all of us, and see how we can salvage this. No, the money is there for the food, it's paid, but it's not doing what it's supposed to be doing because it's in wrong hands. Okay. So maybe even the TB thing, we said here, somebody told us that the mines are no-go areas. You remember? And we started wondering, is this South Africa? It's not Burundi. And somebody tells you this is a no-go area, where is an incubator of, sorry, I used the wrong way. This is not what, I withdraw that one. That this is South Africa. Yeah, no, I withdraw that one unconditionally. Yeah, we are not doing it for other people, we are doing it for ourselves. No, and let's do the best for ourselves. If there is no go area in the mines, which is the incubator of TB, and you can't go in there, you wait, it is a source. It must come out and meet you somewhere, and you try to sort it out. It's like trying to empty the sea with a teaspoon. No, just keep on. It doesn't work out that way. Please. So we enjoin you to do it, not try, just do it. If you don't have them down there, do it for them until they grow up and catch up. Thank you.
James?
Thank you, Chair. I did not get the number of the 52 districts, how many clinics in each district, the 52 community totally, so that when you give us the progress that you do in some of the clinics, at least we know how many recovered in Australia. That's the first one. Secondly, the department, I haven't heard anything much about health education, which is one of our biggest problems. You must remember some of the illnesses that, you know, the neonatal deaths, the maternal, all those, even malnutrition, including, you know, diarrhea, all these, if you can have a drive, or commitment, I don't know how to call it, but commitment of making sure that our people know exactly how do they avoid going to the clinic because the child is dying. How can they grow their babies from birth before they're even born so that they don't get malnourished, breastfeeding and, exclusive breastfeeding. Which means 6 months, and after 6 months that baby can eat food that we eat at home, which when is the child going to be malnourished? Never, because this child has been well looked after, the 2 year, your commitment of that, all that. This education needs to go out there, and we don't find it anymore in our MOUs, and times that we need to begin to get this, not on paper, but where our people are. I can see it on the, Dr. Mohamed said, raised something that as we went around, we never saw the word base. We never saw any of them. That's why we're asking, where are they? So on paper, it's there, but we need to see it. When we do oversight, we really need to see these things happen. That's why we need this ideal clinic. That's why I was asking, it's a dream. Because in that ideal clinic, we'll have education on breastfeeding, we have education on child care, we have education on, we have no trained staff on drug abuse. It's so high in our communities. We haven't trained our nurses to anyone comes into the clinic, they can just detect it from the urine. We don't have this. And this is our primary health care, where our people are forced to go. They can't go anywhere. They don't have medical aid. They've got to go to the clinic. And this is how do they get this? I'm so frustrated. Whenever I listen, it's like the one that I got in 2014. It's like it's stuck, cut and paste. We don't really get the questions that we've probably raised. This is not the first time that I've raised this question. And I never hear any commitment or any program and see it when we go there. Because when we go there, believe you me, it's not there. And it's one. If even the 1394 that passed on, if the families knew, where do they go? we've got this ward with this district psychiatric. Where are they? People should know about them. We have this, we've established this as Department of Health. If you have, you know, information must go out to the people. That's my biggest frustration currently. And thank you, Chair.
No, thanks very much. Well, health education is very key. I met with some of the officials 2 weeks ago around the issue of non-communicable diseases and obesity. I mean, the information that they share with me, it was a revelation. I was hearing it for the first time. And I was asking myself, if this information is not known to us as members, what about ordinary people on the ground? What about ordinary people on the ground? And we have got this biggest problem of these non-communicable diseases. But we don't seem to be a priority focus in terms of mobilizing society and making sure that we confront this matter head on. And this the issue that the Honorable James is raising. We seem not to be out there communicating. The information we have, it's for ourselves. Because your provincial health department is not doing this. Maybe you rely, you think that they're doing something, and they're not doing this at all. And that's a big, big challenge that you have. I'll hand back to you, Honorable Hunter, and I don't know who else. Dr. Pele.
So let me speak about malnutrition. If you look at this slide 20, you will see that we've reached our target for severe acute malnutrition case fatality rates. It's dropped from 9.5 to 7% in the last 3 quarters. Now that's not by accident. That's because we've had teams going to all the hospitals, especially the hospitals, firstly looking at the definitions they've been using, and secondly teaching the doctors and nurses there about proper feeding while they're in hospital, and also looking downstream, because many of the patients that come in with malnutrition are not being picked up early enough in primary health care. So we are looking all the way downstream, including where they are, working with the ward-based outreach team. So that number is coming down because we have a national initiative looking at severe acute malnutrition. The same with exclusive breastfeeding. We had a major international conference on breastfeeding and the importance of breastfeeding, and we had a fair amount of communication around breastfeeding. And again, you can see the breastfeeding rates going up over the last 3 quarters. So certainly for those things that are going up, the reason they are going up is because there's a program. And the program is led from the national department. You know, we have a pediatrician going around to all the hospitals looking at malnutrition, for example. The presidency has called a meeting of all government departments to look at nutrition, because there's an agreement and there's an acknowledgement that while many government departments are working on aspects of nutrition, there's no coordination. So there is, under the deputy president's office now, an attempt to coordinate government departments around nutrition. Now, Honourable Member, whether or not the school feeding program comes back to health or not is not a call I would make. It would be helpful if the committee feels strongly about it to raise it also politically, also in discussion with the committee that deals with the basic education. I would rather not convey my own sentiments about whether the decision that was taken is the right one or the wrong one. Yeah, but it's not about only who provides or who's responsible for it. It's what the children are provided with in terms of, it's the food that they provide with nutritious enough. And are they giving it to them often enough? You know, one meal a day may not be sufficient for some kids, but that's currently what's happening. With respect to the TB diagnostics, no, you're absolutely right. We are providing wall-to-wall coverage with Gene Expert. And that's one of the reasons, Honourable Member, we are picking up all the drug-resistant TB cases. We wouldn't have been picking it up otherwise.
That's why we now have the largest number of patients on bedaquiline, the new TB drug for drug-resistant patients, over 4,000. You know, that's the largest, that's 80% of the world's population on bedaquiline is in South Africa. It's because we're finding them. We can do what other countries without, which I won't name, are doing and not finding them. But we are finding them and putting them on treatment. But it's a, you know, it's continues to be a big problem. The machine I was talking about is the CPAP machine for resuscitation of neonates. That's where we have a challenge because it needs also medical air. So you need a whole range of other things to make the CPAP machines work. But as I said, we've not stopped. We have a pediatrician that started on the 1st of February and we are doing training together with the district clinical specialist teams. And I'm quite confident that we will see the neonatal mortality rates going down. My own target is no more than 8 per thousand. You know, which our target there was 10 per thousand, but my own personal target is 8 per thousand. Because I think we can do even better than 10. Thanks.
I received the report on the mental health team. So Tswane has got one Eden. Limpopo has a team in all five districts, so that makes the seven. From the HOD in Free State has just appointed a team for Thabo Mokgosinyane, which will start 1 March. So when we come to the committee again, we will report that we have 18. The issue of health promotion. We have realized that health promotion doesn't work. It's not happening in our PhD clinics, and it should happen. So what was the idea in the clinics? They have what they call the health promoters, but it's also voluntary workers on stipends. And often these health promoters, the voluntary workers, do not find time because the clinics are busy and there's a noise and people don't want to sit and listen. They want to be helped by a health practitioner, get their medicine and go. So we have completed a manual for the health workers because we think it's the doctors and the nurses who must do the health promotion. There will be a role for health promoters and it will be clearly defined within the bigger scheme of things. But because we say to South Africans, eat healthy, but we don't tell them what we mean by that. We say to South Africans, exercise, but we haven't made simple content available for nurses and doctors to say, in terms of age group categories, how do you quickly but simply advise people to exercise? Chair and members, as part of the Ideal Clinic, we are rearranging the services so that the clinics provide what we call integrated clinical services. Either the nurse practitioner or the doctor must see the patient for everything, for the patient's diabetes, for the hypertension, for the HIV, so that you then make giving health promotion part and parcel of that. I don't know, I hope Dr. Pillay doesn't mind if I ask him just to talk about the department's implementation with the health campaigns.
So, Honourable Members, thanks. We have launched a campaign called PILA, which is the national communications campaign that is trying to focus on the burdens of disease that we have, or the quadruple burden of disease. So there's been communication around HIV and TB, and maternal and child health. We haven't yet communicated, and some on healthy lifestyles. We haven't communicated on violence and trauma as much yet. So the idea is over the next 3 years is to scale up our communication. The challenge, Honourable Members, is, you know, we can do so much from the national department, but we need our colleagues at provinces to also do as much as we are doing, or more, because they are, you know, closer to communities and in touch with communities, together with the districts, which are the responsibility of provinces. We do have a national communicators forum where communicators from provinces and the national department meet, and it's clear that from what honourable members are saying, we need to do more.
I just don't understand where is this one pediatrician that you spoke about going to be held? Where is he going to be? Is it going to be national? Where is this one in? Is she going to be on her own, or does he have somebody? How is it going to be? Because I thought, oh my goodness, 19 provinces, 52 districts. I don't know sub-districts, how many are they?
Honourable Members, so we have district clinical specialist teams in all 52 districts. And these are, you know, those seven people who we were trying to put in place for the last 2.5 years. And one of the members of the district clinical specialist team is a pediatrician, and the other is a pediatric nurse. Now, we don't have pediatricians because of the shortage in every one of the 52 districts, but we've got about 20-something of them in place. So the idea of this pediatrician in the National Department is to work with people in provinces and in the hospitals, starting with those hospitals which have the highest levels of neonatal mortality. And if you look at, you know, the numbers of neonates that die, you will find that the most number, if you're looking just at the number, die in the central and the tertiary hospitals. You know, so I've got a list with me because I've been looking at where she must start working, you know, where she must focus on. So if you look at Dora in Ginza, for example, in the last year, 2016-17, 126 neonates died in Dora in Ginza. If you look at Nelson Mandela, 221 neonates died. So we know where the large numbers of neonates are. But that doesn't mean that Dora in Ginza and Nelson Mandela are doing a bad job. It means that they are either coming there late, they're presenting very sick, etc. But I will start with Dora in Ginza, Nelson Mandela and other hospitals, and also work downstream to look at what is contributing to them. And as I said, there are three major causes of neonatal mortality, one of which is prematurity. But we will be tackling all of these hospitals to look at what more can be done to reduce the neonatal mortality. As I said, my own target is 8.
I want us to conclude this matter. Okay.
You know, the one big failure of the hospitals is primary health care. This is where we fail. And this is where this department fails, because that's where we should be doing all of this work, so that by the time they get to tertiary, we've done our, you know, the work is done. But this is where there's a huge failure. That is why I'm saying that we really need to look at, this is where we empower, where the first time they come to book for the maternity, the MOU. This is where we educate them. Now that you're pregnant, this is how you work, you know, so that we take them on with information, or, you know, we probably say education. And it cannot be a nurse, I can assure you now. I went from the hospital. No nurse has time for that. they've got other things to do. We've got to have the health promotion, the health educator on in our clinics, so that they do this dirty work on the ground. They make sure that we empower people, they know exactly what to do, so that we prevent these neonatals. Thank you, Chair.
Okay, can we move on? Because we can't go on forever. We still have two reports to present it. Can we move on, Doc?
Thanks. I think Dr. Yogan will also touch on more of this initiatives underway to do education through the Mom Connect and Nurse Connect programs. But just to cover some of the things that we've not yet dealt with, in particular the very important questions raised by the Honourable Members in front with regards to target setting, we've noted your concerns and we will try to address these as we move forward. Then one particular issue in relation to target setting, though, that I'd like to address specifically is the one on, again, where we have the number of managers accessing coaching and mentoring programs, which is actually the target, but we report different stories instead of giving the numbers of people accessing. Now, often where we report like that, it's because there are process-related issues that need to be put in place before we can start counting numbers of people being trained or accessing the coaching and mentoring program. And in this instance, because that was a specific question, it was really related to the fact that this target was subject to funding being, donor funding being received through ITEC, and it only became available in October last year. So in the contracting and briefing of the affected management teams happened late, and therefore we could not report actually against the target. I mean, at the risk of sounding defensive, I don't want to sound defensive, but I'm trying to answer that team of the management, the answer of the management hub and the coaching, mentoring and coaching. So much of the knowledge management, this knowledge hub, The numbers are also related to the pilots, and we also received a 24 million award last November, which we are sure will go a long way to strengthening the use of the Knowledge Hub as a tool for coaching and mentoring, and as a resource for managers and providers. Thank you, Chair. Then now I think some of the one or two issues we've noted that we will report in writing. One relates to the infrastructure list. Some issues also from Ms. Hunter, and I have asked Ms. Rennie to list the issues, so we will provide a detailed report through the Secretariat on those issues. Do you want to say something, Tiny?
Yes. Thank you, Honourable Members, and thank you, Dr. Andrews. One particular thing that we will also submit is what the Chair requested regarding the bilateral,
okay,
the detail of the bilateral. But I have listed all the items that we still have to come back to the committee about. Thank you, Chair.
No, that's fine. Thanks very much. Can we move on to Mom Connect, and then we'll have the two presentations together so that we're able to have a discussion on all of them. If there are issues that Honourable Member still wants to come back, while we're discussing the others, you can still come back. I want us to then have the report presentation on the two. And then if there are still issues that you still want to refer back to, you will be required to do so in the process. Can you then hand back to you to present the two items? I don't know whether it's you or somebody else.
Thanks, Chair. I'll do the second one on the placements of health professionals. Dr. Pillay will do the mic for you.
Thank you, Honourable Chair, Honourable Members. So on Mom Connect, the reason this program was put in place, which is a text-based messaging system to pregnant women, many at their first antenatal care visit. And it links to what Honourable James was asking earlier about, are we empowering pregnant women, for example, at clinic level and in communities. So this program is exactly that, Honourable James. It's to empower women, get the information and knowledge about each stage in their pregnancy. So the messages that we send them once they're registered are stage-based. So if they're in the first trimester, they get messages relevant to the first trimester, etc. And they get the messages up to 1 year of post-delivery. So up to 1 year of the child, of the infant's age, they get messages as well. So this just gives you a little bit of the background that we have seen over time a fairly significant reduction in the maternal mortality ratio. And if you look at our latest annual report for 15-16, you will see that the institutional maternal mortality ratio has come down to just under 120. I think honourable members will recall that there was a time where it was around 180. So it's come down in the last 5 years quite substantially. We would like, of course, it to come down by 2019 to below 100. And by 2030, the Sustainable Development Goal target is no more than 70 per 100,000 live births. I think, as honourable members know, there are many factors that impact on maternal death. Some things that happen in communities, things that happen in our facilities, etc. But we do know that early booking is very important. And you will have seen the figures that were previously shown by the COO, that the number of women who are coming in before 20 weeks has increased over time. So that's quite good. And part of the reason it's increased is the Mom Connect program that we've put in place. But it also relates to the role of community-based workers, including the ward-based outreach teams who have been informing moms about the importance of early antenatals. In fact, in parts of Swanee, I got a report 2 weeks ago that the community, the ward-based outreach teams are also taking pregnancy test kits into communities to test women for pregnancy and bringing them to clinics. So where the community outreach workers, where the ward-based teams are, there is some evidence on the community that they are making a difference. I think what we need to do is see that happening at scale, you know, everywhere. So we have contracted the University of Stellenbosch to evaluate Mom Connect. And one of the things they've told us is that the compared to mums that aren't registered on Mum Connect, the ones that are registered have better knowledge and attitudes towards their pregnancies. Mm-hmm. What we have been seeing is quite a lot of compliments and complaints. The next slide, please. Quite a few complaints and compliments from Mum Connect. Please go on, next slide. Reassuring. Right. So this is the latest status on Mum Connect. We have 1.36 million women who have registered to receive messages since August 2014, and they receive messages twice a week up to year one post-delivery. And spontaneous complaints that have been reported in this time are over 1,000, and they are largely around either shortage of drugs, attitudes of health workers, or waiting times. Those are the three major complaints we get. And I'm sure it's no surprise to anyone that those are the complaints. But equally, and this is unsolicited as well, we have about 7 times more compliments, which means that things are improving in our facilities. You know, the things that Ms. Hunter is doing on the Ideal Clinic, the things that provinces are doing, appear to be bearing fruit, even though we still have these over 1,000 complaints. Next. So we know that many nurses also complain that we don't support them. Because I think, as Honorable James said, they're very busy, there are large numbers of patients that they're seeing, and you know, they are equally traumatized by what they see, and many are overworked. So we've got linked to Mum Connect something we've called Nurse Connect, focusing in the first instance on midwives and nurses providing antenatal care to support them. So they get messages since May last year. 14,000 nurses have registered to get sent the messages that are motivational in nature and technical in nature, so providing them with information too. So we're not only through Mum Connect providing mums with information about their pregnancy, we also think it's important to update nurses both technically and also provide them with support. And we are in the process of developing a health desk where nurses can also ask for assistance should they get stuck doing something. So the idea with both of these is to empower on the demand side pregnant women and their partners, as well as them to help their infants. But we also think it's important for us to empower the nurses who bear the brunt of the service delivery challenges that we all see. So the last slide, I think that's it. So I think that's where I would stop, Honorable Chair. Thank you very much.
No, thanks very much. Can you get the last presentation? Just to indicate why we wanted a briefing on this matter. The background is beyond it. You will recall that last year there was an outcry in the media and everywhere, that there seems to be a challenge in terms of the placement of doctors, medical doctors and pharmacists. There seems to be no space available or no budget available for them to be placed. And then the minister came in and said, that is not going to happen. All medical doctors and pharmacists, they are going to be placed. But then subsequent to that, I then personally received a complaint from professional nurses that they are not being placed after having completed their qualification. And I got a list, and they submitted the list to the ministry's office. And unfortunately, we didn't get any joy from the responses from the ministry. The eager and the commitment and the will that was displayed about the doctors and pharmacists, we didn't get it. It's the same eager and commitment around the placement of professional nurses. And it is our view that primary health care is a cornerstone, and that's where the challenge is. Wherever we've gone, there's nowhere we've gone we found that there is enough health workers. The chair, for example, was telling me that last week one clinic was not functioning. People were toying because nurses were saying, no, we are going on, we are not working on leave. I mean, it's our off day and there's nobody to replace them. But by those people who are not absorbed for severance. So we felt, therefore, that the department must come and make a presentation to us as to this year how many medical doctors were produced and how many have been placed and how many have not been placed and why. How many pharmacists were produced? How many have been placed? How many have not been placed and why? How many professional nurses? Same thing, placed, not placed, and why? And what system are being put in place to resolve this matter? If there are still those that are standing. As I'm saying, I received a list of those that have not, and they have been telling me that they have been put from pillar to post in the department, and there's no commitment that they are going to be placed anytime soon. And they are on the street as we speak. So that's the reason why we felt, no, let's call you to come in account and tell us exactly what's happening about this matter. Over to you.
Thanks, Honourable Chair, and thanks for that background. I'll take you through the presentation and then we can see who has managed to address the concerns. Now, the presentation relates specifically, as you pointed out, to medical doctors, pharmacists, and professional nurses. With regard to the medical doctors, medical internships, for medical interns, there's a two-year placement in health professional council accredited hospitals. The graduates from the various facilities are mixed using a simple ratio, basically proportional to the graduates from the from the universities in the province. Graduates from SADC countries can only apply after approval by their respective governments, and non-residents are subject to the Immigration Act. The Department of Health can only make them offers once all South Africans are placed. In terms of the medical interns, South African interns applying for medical internships, we have received a total of 1499 applications. We placed 1482. 17 applicants declined to be placed. This comes from the applicants themselves. So with the result that we made a total of 1498 offers, therefore placing 99.9% of our applications received, and there's one placement only pending. The placement that is pending, we referred the matter to the Health Professions Council of South Africa. With regards to the non-South Africans applying for medical internships, we received 73. Lesotho nationals have been removed from placements because of the specific request made by their government. 48 were placed. No applicants declined to be placed. So we made an offer of 48 to place all those who applied, and therefore we have a 65% placed out of the total applications considered. There are 25 placements pending for the non-South Africans applying for medical internships. In terms of South African doctors applying for community service, we received 1,064 applications for medical officer community service placements. We placed 1,057 because 7 declined placement, and therefore we've reached our 100% placement target. In terms of non-South African doctors, we've also achieved 100% placement, having placed all applications received. We made a total number of offers to these non-South African doctors. Honourable members, in terms of the pharmacists applying for community service, we had
applications which we receive from for community service pharmacy placements, three applicants declined to be placed, so we placed the remaining 713, therefore achieving 100% coverage. With regards to non-South Africans applying for community service in the field of pharmacy, we received 79 applications and they all were placed because there were no people who declined to be placed. Now coming to the nurses, we know that nurses are the largest single professional grouping in South Africa and thus also the largest group to be placed for community service. Their placement has a unique challenge in relation to the other professionals. Excuse me. In that nurses graduate at different times. Thank you. So the 75.66% of professional nurses must, firstly, they must serve in a specific province or facility due to a public service obligation or bursary obligation. So the province that gives them their bursaries, they must be placed in that province. And then as I said, the completion dates vary and therefore there's an extended placement period for these students. But even in the light of that, those challenges, we've received a total of 3,140 applications. Only one applicant declined to be placed, and we placed 2,873. Therefore, 100% placement was achieved, and we still have 266 placements pending for the professional nurses. Now, with regards to the 266 placement pending applicants, 52% are applicants who studied at Gauteng College and will only be placed from April 2017 due to delays in their examinations. There are also several provinces who requested reallocations of nurses placing and increased the number to be placed since the 30th of January. We also received 47 late applications in January, and these individuals will be placed in April. And maybe, Chair, some of these things relate to some of the complaints you have received. Thank you very much, Honourable Members, for your attention.
No, thanks very much. Can we, Members, ask clarity second question starting from the Mom connect to the last presentation, if there are any. Honorable Sinakunyane, Honorable Marisela.
Thank you very much, Chair. I'm just going to ask in terms of the placement. What are the implications of declining placement? Because the first column says these are applicants. If you apply and then it declines, what are the reasons needed and what are the implications? I mean, what are the implications? And then in terms of the non-RSA, and I saw that you also indicated that they are pending. Are there countries going to, I didn't quite get you. You may have explained, but I didn't quite understand. And then the last one is, what does it mean when you say provinces request reallocation? If you can just speak to those things. Thank you.
Thank you.
This presentation of our slides is very scanty. What the statistics you gave, they are not in this. So if we could get what you have just been presenting, that would be very helpful. That's number one. Number two, Mom Connect is a very useful tool. But you need money to connect. And I wonder whether when they get to the clinic, they load some data for them to access Mount Connect or this thing. They are very poor people who actually who go to, who use Mount Connect, because the well-heeled go to Brandhurst and other private clinics. They don't go to Soweto Clinic, Zola Clinic. So it is a very useful tool, but if it is not well resourced, it will be just another pink elephant with good intentions. Because you see, we forget one thing, that we are sitting here trying to talk about health, and sometimes we don't even try to talk about the drivers, the main drivers of ill health. We just talk about how to fix somebody who broke his leg, how to give you aspirin if you have a headache. And we know headache is not a disease, but we pump you with all those things and without trying to sort out what is the problem. The major driver of ill health is poverty, and we can't solve it. I mean, ours is to, because you see, we have learned to do curative, not the preventative medicine. So you come, you are sick, you come, we give you medicine, and we help the pharmaceutical companies to get richer and richer. Instead of, and Mom Connect could have been a basis for preventative medicine, you know? But the poverty mediate against this, because if you have this project of wash your hands, tell children to wash their hands at school. Oh, by the way, one thing, you said there were school out health outreach teams. I haven't seen one so far of those teams. And by the time maybe they come round to the school that is near me, I would have been on pension. I wouldn't even know. So maybe they are still coming. We are very optimistic they will come one day. But by then, half of the children in that area would have died of things like diarrhea, simply because hygiene has not been taught. Simple things like, because of poverty. And even if you teach the child how to wash hands and there is no soap at home to wash those hands, it's another problem. But if you taught the mother the importance of just making the child wash their hands, whether before eating and after eating, whether you use a spoon or not, it's one step towards preventable diseases. Prevention is better than cure. But we are not emphasizing that side of medicine. We are emphasizing other things. We talk, we quarrel about procurement and all sorts of things. But if we were quarreling about how many nurses are part of the robots, they could have picked up malnutrition, which could have been missed at the clinic. In fact, the child wouldn't even have to go to the clinic, because they would have picked that at home. But we don't emphasize we don't prioritize priorities. We prioritize something that causes a lot of money. No, because we assume everybody has got that money to spend, and is promoted big time. Now, here is a simple tool, Mom Connect. But you see, you forget to give me airtime or data to connect. I don't have. I put it in the pocket and wait the day they phone me at the clinic. I can't connect with them and ask them about the question that, you know what, this child looks like it's not growing at the rate that it must. Or maybe the mass, the ratio, the child becoming fat or obese, what is the problem? Because they throw pap in the child's mouth. You know, they make pap with water and make soft and pushing the child. The child cries until it gets fed, tired of crying, and keep quiet. They say, now it's full. Full of what? Now, those are some of the things that could be taught through Mom Connect. I don't just give children pap and water until the stomach is full. You are killing the child through malnutrition. You are causing the child death. Because malnutrition does not necessarily mean lack of food. What type of food are you giving, and when, and how, at what quantities, and all sorts of things. So maybe let's use this tool effectively by trying to make sure it is used the way it's supposed to be used. It's not just, and of course, the other thing is that do those people have smartphone, or is it just another phone to say hello, hello, and talk? It's another thing. Poverty is the bane of hell. Thank you.
Honorable James.
Thank you, sir. I was just going to ask if are we going to get to the updated was we don't have it. So that we can refresh with the page.
No, thanks very much. Well, I'm not sure whether you don't talk to each other, as I've indicated. You see, this information was given to the department of the students that have not been, in a professional license, that has not been absorbed by the department. And they are not on provincial bursaries. The majority of them are on NSFAS. And the majority of the students, if not all of them, were at TUT that were not absorbed. That's what they told me, to TUT. And they have been promised since last year. They've done their work. They've been promised last year that they're going to be placed. And since January, they've been told many stories by the officials. One official is called Tutugan or Tutugil or something in the department. Firstly, they were told, you know, Gauteng and Mpumalanga in particular. He said, no, they don't have budget to place them. That's the first story that they were told. And therefore, they will talk to Northwest. No? And then later they were communicated that no, they've agreed with Northwest and they indicated the districts in which they are supposed to be placed. And when the day came, they communicated to the district concerned and the district said, no, we know nothing about you. And that's how they became frustrated to an extent that they then communicated this information to the chief. They didn't communicate directly to me. They communicated to the chief's office. And the chief's office then referred them to myself. And then I asked them to forward the information, the list. They forwarded the list to me, and I forwarded the list to the department. And I was told by the office of the minister that no, they're saying this number that I've given them is not even a complete number. That's what one of your officials in the department said. They said it's more than the number that is here that they are unable to place. That's what they told the office of the minister. But they've got more than the number that I've given them. The problem is bigger than this problem I'm giving. But we are giving a different picture altogether. To say, no, there's no board who is not placed. All professional nurses that have been placed, those 66. Pending placement and the reasons behind the pending placement is not the reason that is related to this issue at all. These ones are not placed that more than 100 and something, but they said about 140 more than what I've given, that are not placeable because there's no money to place them, there's no budget. And there's no way we are talking about budget constraints. That's what the office of the minister told me, and that's what these students were told by officials in the department. And the information you are giving us now is completely different. It means the right-hand side as in stock to the left-hand side. The same thing that the health ombudsman raised when he was presenting his report, if you recall. That he asked three officials about the figures, And all of them gave them three different figures. As the HOT gave them something, a number, he asked the MEC, gave a particular figure, he asked the director responsible, he gave them a different figure, and that's what is happening now. This is an official document you're presenting to us. But your officials have got something else that you don't have. And how authentic is this information then? That's my biggest worry, my biggest problem. Because the problem is still there. They even asked, they were phoning me last week, this week, on Monday, yesterday, to say, are you winning on this matter of our placement? All the students from TUT have not been placed. Unfortunately, we didn't indicate in which institutions are all these 3,000 something that were placed are coming from. And how many are from TUT from that one. Unfortunately, we don't have that breakdown of the detailed information, where each one is coming from, so that at least we have got a bigger picture. But the fact of the matter is, there are professional nurses that have not been placed, which runs to hundreds. And the information they are being told is that there's no budget for placement. And that's why we thought you are going to give us the correct picture, so that we then say, what then is the way forward? But you are giving us a gloomy picture. So, you know, everything is fine. You are doing very well. Everybody is placed. Those that are not placed, there is a justifiable explanation why they are not placed. And that's our biggest worry. And then the issue of Mom Connect and the issue that Doc was raising around school health program. You see, January we visit schools as part of the school reopening program. I visited various schools and asked them about this integrated school health program. No, they don't know. The schools doesn't know anything about it. Where I've gone. They said, no, nurses will come, immunization will come into that. But the integrated health schools program to check people about the hearing, the eyesight, therapy, and all that. No, they don't know about that. They don't know. I don't know why is it happening. I don't know. So Doc is saying maybe it's going to happen when he is retired. And they even told me that when they inquire to the nearest health facility, no, they will tell them, no, we don't know. The people that they come somewhere and come and do these things and go, we don't have any relationship with them. So there's no connection between the school and the health facility that is there, or a community health center, or even a hospital or a clinic. There's nothing. So these people are coming somewhere. Come do what they want to do. There's no plan, there's no discussion, no agreement even with the schools. They just come in. But when you look into your plan, there seems to be a memorandum of understanding that has been entered between yourself and basic education. But that thing is not there on the ground. There's no such understanding that they should work together. Nurses, when they come as nurses and come into what they're supposed to do without even the understanding of the school itself, what is it that the intention is all about. And that's the biggest problem. That's the biggest challenge. Then the issue of Mom Connect, I'm not sure how you're dealing with people that are staying in the very deep rural areas where we have got challenges of connectivity. Because we can't run away that there's still a problem of connectivity in South Africa. And then how do you manage that area where there's this challenge of connectivity and the issue around your mobile system, where it's not consistent? Because where there are no, most of the rural areas and the farm areas where there are no health facilities. They've got mobile clinics. And those mobile clinics are not consistent because of the issue that we've been talking about earlier on, of the infrastructure, of the availability of equipment. Because they will tell you there are no cars, nurses can't go there because the mobile vehicle is not there or it is broken, and once it's broke, it will take 6 months to a year for the provincial government to fix it. And at that period of time, there's no connection between those women who are pregnant to receive the service that they're supposed to receive. And sometimes they need to travel long distances for them to access health facilities because the mobile is either not there or if it's there, there's no consistency in terms of availability. And that's the biggest challenge that we have. Some of us are working there in those rural areas. There's a deep frustration around access to health in those areas. Okay, thanks very much. Can you comment on this matter?
Thanks, Chairperson. And thanks, honourable members, for the questions and observations made. We will also make the presentation available immediately. I'd like to ask Dr. Andrew Crichton to respond to all the questions, and I've put up this slide so that you can also use it by way of illustrating what things are actually meaning here, because he's actually responsible for the placement of students. So maybe he'll have some in-depth programmatic answers he can provide. And then Dr. Pillay and Ms. Hunter will respond to the questions around schoolhouse and Mom Connect, and the Chief Nursing Officer will also make some comments and observations on nursing after Dr. Crichton has spoken. Thank you.
Thanks, Honourable Chair and members. The situation is correct in your assessment that there is a large number of nurses that must be placed for community service. In that group of 266, which was at the beginning of 2 weeks ago was as low as 13, has been climbing because provinces who have indicated that they had posts available for community service for nurse placements started withdrawing those posts. So what they did then was we would place the person in a post which they had indicated was available for placement for community service, and then would ask us to reallocate the person to another province. You were mentioning Gauteng and TUT in particular, and Gauteng was one of the first provinces to start this trend of once all their bursars had been placed, to then withdraw all our other available posts for us to be able to place individuals. KZN bucked the trend, and they actually came to the party and put 48 additional posts into the mix so that they could absorb their students that were coming from the universities. So the challenge, Chair, that we're having is that provinces who had indicated that we had sufficient posts to place nurses were now withdrawing those posts and were asking for reallocation. So the numbers started climbing. So the feedback that you were receiving from the individuals affected, that they had been placed and then they were told they were not placed because of budgetary constraints, is essentially the correct in terms of what we've been doing. As we've been trying to place individuals as quickly as possible, we would go to other available posts such as Northwest, but very soon Northwest also started having problems and then requested to have placements stopped in the province. So what we've done about this is that just like we did with medical interns when we were having challenges placing them, we have written to the provinces, we've indicated to them the number of individuals that we need to place, and those are the individuals we're asking them to assist us in placement. We are clear on the matter that this is a statutory placement, and this is not, we are not sort of asking for a favour, we are trying to get these individuals placed as soon as possible because that is the understanding we have around community service. So the challenge going forward is really to be able to get these individuals placed as quickly as possible. There are, as indicated in the slide, there is other individuals that also need to be placed that are on extended programs. So, for example, with Gauteng, they have individuals in their nursing colleges who wrote exams late and will need to be placed late. So we're working in a very fiscally tight environment with provinces, and we're trying to get them to assist us as far as possible. Several provinces have indicated to us that in the new financial year they should be able to assist us more freely than what they can at the moment. We're trying to communicate as best as possible with the affected individuals, but we understand their frustration in that they would like to be placed so that they can start their community service and complete it to continue with their full registration. In terms of what the implications are if individuals decline, now individuals decline for a range of reasons, but it usually they decline because they didn't get what they specifically asked for. So usually it's I want to be placed in a specific town or a specific hospital, either in the Western Cape, Gauteng or KZN. Of the group that we have, only three of those individuals that have indicated that they require that they decline placement have declined it on specific reasons that we couldn't accommodate something that relates to a special consideration. So, for example, they declined because they're married and we can't place them close enough to their spouse at this point in time. All those individuals are prioritized and we will place them as soon as we can. And posts do become available, especially around community service and medical interns, because there's always a group, the group is never exclusive, so there's always people that started later, and so posts, small numbers of posts become available throughout the year, and we would be able then to assist them. So, but the reasons vary. So, for example, one individual declined their placement because they're currently living in Cape Town and they're looking after properties of their parents that live in Belgium. We had another person that declined because their 3 million rand horse cannot be transported from the Western Cape to any other province because of concerns around illnesses and diseases. So some of it's actually quite strange, and the rest of it, but there are cases where we definitely are trying to prioritize. For the non-South Africans and that are still pending placement, what we do with them is we waitlist them, and as soon as we have positions available, we will then make those offers to them. We found that non-South Africans tend to accept the placements unless they come from certain countries such as Canada, UK, or Europe in general, because then again it's a case of I want to be in the Western Cape or so forth. We did have people who declined because they believed the hospital they were placed in was not a suitable training venue. Now, we reject that outright because we don't accredit those sites. The Health Professions Council accredits those sites, and if they are accredited, then they are obviously suitable for medical internships. The term reallocation is a term that we use, which implies that the province, we have placed a person in the province in a post that we understood was available and which the province had indicated was available, and they have asked us, they've sent that placement back to us and asked us to reallocate the person to another post in province. And those provinces would be, for example, that I discussed around Gauteng. So one of the things, Chair, that we've taken note is we've had four reviews of the 2017 placement cycle with four different stakeholder groups, and the intention of that review was to understand in quite granular detail what the current situation is and how things are changing in our environment, especially around posts and funding. And we have already started engaging provinces quite actively to deal with some of the root causes, and there are some what I believe is viable proposals, especially around dealing with where funding comes from for posts, which could assist at a provincial level to avoid the situation repeating for the 2018 cycle.
You know what is confusing me? If you can go back to the slides of placement of nurses. You see what's confusing me is that where there are foreign nurses, you're saying before you could place a foreigner, you start with your own, place them, done. Then from there, if there are still spaces available, then you go to foreigners. But as it applies to nurses, you have done the opposite. Why? You have placed all the foreign nurses, but you can't place all your own nurses. I don't understand the logic. Can you explain that?
Chair, it might be a misinterpretation. Nurses who are not South African residents are not required to do community service, therefore they are not placed. It is only South African residents that are placed for community service. So that's why we just put the non-South African professional nurses do not perform community service, because of the other slides where we separated the South Africans from the non-South Africans. So Chair, I might have misspoken, but the professional nurses who do community service are only those that are South African residents. Non-residents do not perform community service for nurses.
Yeah, but how do you place those foreign nurses if you still have your own statutory nurses that you need to place, and you are unable to place, but you are able to place from foreign professional nurses at the expense of those that are statutory? How do you justify that?
Chair, I'm not sure if I'm understanding the question correctly, but we place no foreign professional nurses because they are not entitled for placement, or they do not require placement. So we didn't place any foreign South African, any foreign professional nurses, because it's not a requirement. There's no statutory requirement to place them. So the only nurses that we have placed are South African residents.
Okay.
I thought before you go, did you want to say something, Chair? No.
Thanks, Honourable Chair, members. I think my input would relate to providing clarity on a specific concern around placement of nurses that followed programs offered at TUT in particular. Those students are affected by how nursing education is financed in provinces. In Gauteng in particular, they do not provide, they provide bursaries to both colleges and universities, but because of whatever arrangement, when Gauteng department provided bursaries for nurses that are pursuing BK, they excluded TUT. Invariably, TUT students do not form part of the package of the bursary provision that is given to others. And the part of the package include creation of posts for community services. And in TUT as an institution, they've raised this issue with Gauteng department that they are not able to access the benefits like other tertiary institutions simply because of the funding approach in Gauteng.
I wish to understand you, Makai, but I don't, because community service, is it a provincial matter or it's a national matter? And those students, as I've indicated, the majority of them, if not all of them, were given loan through NSFAS. And they are required to be placed for community service. And they have not been told that they are not going to be placed. Whether they are doing practicals in those facilities and all everything. And nobody said, no, you are not going to be placed. No, because you don't qualify for placement. And even today, as we speak, nobody has told them they don't qualify for placement. Nobody. So that's why I'm saying I don't understand it. It was not a Gauteng matter. There are not only Gauteng, there are some from Mpumalanga, students that have gone through TUT, and they funded through NSFAS. So I don't understand it. So if what the issue that they're raising vis-a-vis the issue, I'm not sure that I understand it properly.
Chair, I think maybe on this issue, if I can propose that we do a brief report also on this issue, because I'm not sure that whether this problem also extends to private institutions, because typically provinces would fund nursing bursaries from the Department of Health budget in the province. And I'm thinking now, maybe as nursing is, landscape is transforming, students might be accessing bursaries through NSFAS or funding themselves, maybe working to fund themselves. And then, unfortunately, at the end of the day, they're not in this pool of students who now can be placed, but it should be addressed. So I think let us do an assessment report and come up with a response, because the problem may even be bigger than these students who have already complained. Okay?
No, it's fine, because but when they're supposed to do practicals, you know them, you accept them.
Exactly.
But when you're supposed to place them, no, you don't know them.
No.
That's what I don't understand. Because even if I've paid out of my own, if you don't know me, why don't you know me when you're supposed to place me? But when I come for practice, you know me. You use me, I do practice and everything with you. And then when I request for placement before I write my exam, you agree that you're going to place me. You even tell me where to be placed. But at the 11th hour, when I'm now supposed to be physically placed, you told me that you don't even say you're not placeable. You said, no, we don't have budget for you. We can't place you. That's my problem.
Yeah. Thanks, Honourable Chair. I think, like I say, another question I'd like to add for the team to look at specifically is, typically when students are placed through the province, and when the bursaries are given, and I know this because I myself was a nursing student, you know, the province that takes responsibility for you, for your bursary, to ensure that you're able to do your practicals, when you do practicals, you're also exposed to occupational injuries. So you get covered in that way. I would also like us to upfront look at the issue of these students who are not covered through the provincial bursaries, and they're covered through NSFAS. When they do their practicals, does the province also take responsibility for any injuries that may result from the placement of those nurses there, should they acquire occupational-related injuries? So I think we need to look at all these issues and just come with a report at some stage. Thank you. I think then we can move on to Dr. Palaya and Musanta to respond to Mom Connect and the issues raised there.
No, it's fine, but it can be at some stage, because at some stage can be June, can be October, can be December next year. There must be definite a cut-off process. When are you going to come back, and when are you going to make sure that you address this matter? Because it can be, because when he was even presented, I said, no, we're still looking at how to place them. There's no definite indication when do you want to do that. And that's my biggest problem.
Chairperson, I'm not sure if I should ask the team to propose a cut-off date or we will try and complete the task as soon as possible. Maybe I'm looking for guidance. Time.
Through you, Chair. I think the committee can prescribe to us how soon they need it, and then we'll work around that.
Can we get the issue around the MomCon? We'll come back to what we think should be the deadline.
Thanks, Chair. The good news, Honourable Maitela, is that it's free to the moms. The MomConnect messages are free, so they don't pay a thing. We are paying from the department, from the national department. So it's totally free, and it's both feature phones and smartphones, so it doesn't matter what kind of phone it is. Simple talking to the phone one also. because we fully understood that those were the challenges, that many of the moms don't have, you know, the smart gadgets, but they have a phone. The challenge, though, is connectivity. I mean, you know, we can't run away from the connectivity thing. And, you know, quite clearly, MomConnect is not going to solve all our problems. It'll solve some problems. Other problems, we'll have to use the ward-based outreach teams, as honourable members were saying. We'll have to strengthen primary health care, as honourable members were saying. So it's a, you know, we have to look at it more comprehensively. So it won't solve all of our problems. On the integrated school health program, we have about 600 teams. And, you know, we've got about 27,000 schools. So clearly, there's a big mismatch. And I'm not surprised, honourable member, when you say when you go to school, you may not have found them all. They don't know. But clearly, we also need to improve the communication between the clinic and the school to ensure that... Now, what typically happens is that the school is supposed to tell the nurses when they can come so that they don't disrupt the school program. That's the arrangement we have with the Department of Basic Education, because the Department of Basic Education is very concerned that this is not disruptive to the learning and teaching, as they call it. But clearly, we can do more. I think, you know, what's really coming across, honourable members, is that we from the department are claiming to do a lot of things, and certainly we have the evidence that we are doing it. So it's not a figment of our imagination that all of these things are happening. But clearly we are not conveying the information to you in the way that you can see it on the ground when you do your visits. And I think we need to find ways of correcting that across the board, not, you know, whether it's the WOVOTS or the integrated school health program or nutrition or whatever. And I think we need another way of communicating to the honourable members the kinds of things we're doing, which schools are being visited, especially in your constituencies. And we'll have to, I think, find a way of doing that. Thank you very much.
Chair, I had just one response. I forgot to respond to the honourable member who asked how many clinics we have. We have 3,744 clinics. Over all 52 districts, the number of clinics per province follows the provincial population, except for Eastern Cape. Eastern Cape has the most clinics because they are those tiny little clinics, but it's also because of geographical obstruction. In the Eastern Cape, for example, a river or a big donga running through, that although people are close to this clinic, they can't get to it, although the Eastern Cape has got this project of building those footbridges. And then, of course, second after Eastern Cape is KZN, has more clinics in their Gauteng and so on, Chair.
No, thanks very much. Is it possible that we will give you until the 24th to give us a detailed analysis of this placement of professional nurses? And then, where practical possible, not wait until the 24th, place them where it is, where you detect the problem, intervene, deal with it. When you come back, you tell us how far have you gone and the intervention that you've made. Will that be fine? Okay. Can we move towards closure? I'll give you the last bite, Honorable Maisa. Look, there is a meeting that must take place here.
The other intervention is just is don't allow people to train when they are not going to be placed anyway. we wanted to start a thorough placement method of starting at the ward, and that being paid that month as you enroll. So that one is guaranteed. You go in there, if they allow you to get into that college, you are sure you are working in a hospital. So this one's where you just go and come with lots of certificates and you start marketing yourself, you are going to have problems. Thanks.
Honourable Sims, you wanted to say something earlier on?
Yes, thanks, Chase. I just wanted to say that I was a bit concerned that you had to dig out the information with questions after we got the report that didn't really divulge all the information that we got now from the department. That is worrying. When coming to the portfolio, please bring all the right information, because we work in these communities, we get the information of the communities, we lead us there, and to come to us with half baked, look you can just look at the presentation. I'm not happy about it. So just make sure that when you come to the portfolio, bring us the right information in where we know exactly why we were invited to the portfolio. Thank you very much for the information.
No, thank you very much. Let's take this opportunity to thank the officials in the department for the reports that you have presented and the information that you have presented is highly appreciated. We hope that the issues that we have said we are going to submit, that we never put a deadline. We leave it to you. The sooner the better. We're not going to say bring it by this time. We will rely on yourself. That's one. But the second matter that I wanted to raise, it's a concern for me from the department. We deal with the budget in April, May, June. Yeah? Present a report to Parliament with the recommendations. And in those recommendations, we say, if my memory serves me well at the end, the department is expected to give progress report on those recommendations every 3 months after the report has been adopted. That doesn't happen. We have never received any. In October, we deal with the budgetary review. We present a report in the National Assembly and say 3 months after a report has been adopted, the department must bring progress report. We have never received since 2014. That has not happened. I'm not sure whether you received the reports. If you don't, I don't know why Joe is not giving you the report, because he's a parliamentary person. Because once the report gets adopted by Parliament, it becomes a report, therefore, that must be at the disposal of the department. And then the department is expected, therefore, to go through the report of the portfolio committee, look at whether, because it's no more recommendation, it's now resolutions from the House. Becomes a recommendation from the committee. When it gets adopted by the House, the resolutions from the House. And therefore, the expectation is that, therefore, the department is expected to act on those resolutions and come back to Parliament on those resolutions. But it has never happened. It has never happened. For the past 3 years I've been here, I've never seen your responses on any of those. I don't know where lies the problem. Maybe at some point in outside this meeting, Joe will have to account to us somewhere. but I'm raising this because it has been just business as usual. And unfortunately, we have never raised it. But I felt I must raise it officially with yourselves. And then try to look into this matter and then where is the crack? What happened? Because there must be crack somewhere. And how then do we, going forward, do we begin to address that? So that it doesn't become as an exercise, a normal exercise. No, you come to the committee does what they say, then it's fine. Business as usual. It can't be right. It can't be right. We need to begin to change that approach and see how then going forward to improve on that particular matter. Thanks very much for the presentation and thanks very much, honourable members. As I've indicated, at 4 o'clock there is a meeting. Next week we are going to having two meetings. On Tuesday we'll be joining Finance, Standing Committee on this sugar, sweetened beverages. Public hearing is continuing. Then on Wednesday, if things go according to our plans, we'll have the minister, we'll have the health ombudsman and the CEO of the Office of the Health Compliance Standard on this issue of mental ill patients in Gauteng. Thanks very much for the meeting, Mr. Chair.
See, you know what I was talking about. What report is talking about?
It's not automatic.
Yeah, and we must read it.
Yeah.